Spit that out right now. This is the Superhuman Channel.
The following paid program does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the staff and management of Tri-Scepter Productions or the Superhuman Channel. Tri-Scepter Productions and the Superhuman Channel are not responsible for any claims, warranties, or guarantees made during this program.
Prepare to experience the strongest radio allowable by law. Secrets will be revealed. Myths dispelled. From the studio gym where excuses never apply. It's Superhuman Radio with your host, Carl Lenore.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Superhuman Radio. We have a important jam-packed show for you today. First, we'll be talking to Dr. Bruce Blumberg about the fetal exposure to tributin linked to obesity in offspring. Then we're going to switch up and talk about the new BPA substitutes and what potential dangers there are in those with Dr. Cheryl Watson. And then we're going to, the second hour is going to be dedicated to the decreased melatonin secretion associated with high risks of developing type 2 diabetes. All subjects that we bang the drum for frequently on this show. And we're going to get started right away and not waste any time. How you doing, Dr. Blumberg?
Very well, Carl.
You know, Dr. Blumberg, I told you this off the air, and my audience has heard me say this time and time again, that as humans, we have embraced a perfect storm of things that disrupt and destroy our bodies. So let's be clear about something. This is just one of the things that potentially has effects on the potential obesity epidemic we have right now, right?
I agree, yes. There are many, many factors in obesity and why we have an epidemic, and I believe, and a fair number of other people now believe, that chemical exposure early in life is a contributing factor.
Okay, so let's talk about this particular chemical, tributin. Is that, am I pronouncing it right?
That's correct.
Okay. So what exactly is tributin?
So tributin is, it's a combination of the metal tin and some organic molecules. It was originally developed to be painted on ship hulls as a replacement for copper to prevent all sorts of marine organisms from growing there. If you've ever had a boat and put it in the water, you know that lots of stuff just sticks to there and grows, and that makes the boat go slower through the water.
Right.
But the huge ships used to put copper on the bottom to keep things from growing, because copper is very toxic. It kills all kinds of marine invertebrates. So tributin was a big advance in that it didn't kill everything. But it had a separate effect, and that's that it sex reversed snails.
Interesting. So it had that effect on snails. It could actually change the sex of snails.
Yes, or change the sex part. So what it does, snails are hermaphrodites; they have both sexes. But it would make the penis grow to 1,000 times or so its normal size, and obviously the parts don't fit, and the animals are sterile.
Wow. Okay, so fast forward, how does it get into human distribution, so to speak?
Okay, so tributin is now banned for use on ship hulls, but it's replaced with a chemical that's equally troublesome called trifenyltin. It's used, so it still contaminates seafood. It's used in plastics. Sometimes, I would say most of the use is unintentional. It comes along for the ride with related compounds. It's used in paints to prevent fungus from growing. You know, we have this obsession these days in many places with mold.
Yeah.
Every kind of, you know, you see a little mildew in your bathroom, and people are all of a sudden calling the hazmat squads.
Right.
As if every kind of mold is deadly. It's not. So it's used to prevent mold from growing. It's used as a wood preservative. So we encounter it in lots of ways, potentially.
Now you said it's a byproduct sometimes that kind of rides along unintentionally. Are you talking about when we combine certain chemicals, we get this as a residual agent in the end product?
Something like that. So, for example, PVC plastic uses related compounds called monobutyltin and dibutyltin as heat stabilizers. So it's required to form the plastic, and they use quite a bit of it actually. Now, the way that you make monobutyl and dibutyltin is you take tetrabutyltin and you kick off two or three of the butyl groups.
Mm-hmm.
So So you can imagine that that's not a 100% complete reaction, and you have some tetrabutyltin and tributyltin left.
Right, right.
And if you buy the stuff from a chemical supplier, it'll say 96% pure dibutyltin. They don't say what the other 4% is, but you can guess what that other 4% is.
Yeah, because it's an aggregate of all the mist, if you will, that didn't turn out the way they wanted it to be. So it could
exactly.
be any range, any spectrum of those chemicals. Okay, so exactly. talk about the research that your group did.
So we've been working on tributyltin for some years now. It's too long to explain how we got into it, but we were testing chemicals in collaboration with labs in Japan on a totally different story, and I was at a meeting in Japan, and I heard a guy get up and say that tributyltin sex reverses fishes in addition to snails. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I called back to the lab. We were already testing tributyltin on another receptor, and I said, guys, test it on all the receptors, the hormone receptors, and let's see what it does. And to our surprise, it activated a receptor called PPAR gamma that is the key regulator of fat cell development. So once we knew that, there was only one way to go with the research is to study its effect on weight gain and fat cells.
Interesting, interesting. Now, if there are different classifications of these endocrine disruptors, some seem to be estrogenic in compounds. Is this one androgenic in compounds? The only reason why I ask that is because it made the genitalia, the male genitalia of the snails grow larger, and we know that DHT has that ability in humans.
Yep. So that's a good question. And what it is, it's not, what it does is it prevents the production of estrogen. So you probably know that estrogens in the body are produced from testosterone. And they're produced from testosterone by an enzyme called
aromatase.
C450 aromatase.
Right, right.
So tributyltin inhibits both the expression and the activity of aromatase.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you end up with more testosterone than you would have otherwise.
Well, there's another side to this. We know that estrogen is produced, or estradiol is produced on demand in the brain through local aromatization, quite often as a response to protect the brain against various insults that we may not even know are going on.
Mm-hmm.
The lack of ability for the brain to produce estradiol on demand has been linked with a variety of neurological disorders found in postmenopausal women. So while this isn't specific to postmenopausal women, anything that could potentially change the landscape of aromatization has the potential to do unknowingly damage the neurological system.
You're exactly right. And I was just giving a talk last week in Rochester, and someone there said, well, what happens to the brains of your tributyltin-exposed animals? And I said, I don't know. That's not our expertise. And she said, you mean you're not looking at the brains? Send me the brains.
Yeah.
So you make a very valid point.
Yeah, this is really interesting. So in the tests that you did in this rodent study, did you expose them to ridiculously high levels of tributyltin or these real-world exposure levels that humans would see?
Real-world exposure levels that humans could see. And the reason I say could see is because no one is measuring what humans are exposed to. So the way it's established what level of any kind of chemical we're allowed to be exposed to is based on rodent studies. So toxicologists treat rodents with high doses of chemicals and come down, 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 down until they find a level that gives no obvious effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's called the NOEL, the no observed adverse effect level. So once that level is established, then the EPA says, okay, that's the NOEL. We're going to apply a safety factor to determine the allowable human exposure. And the typical safety factor is 100. And then that's the allowable human intake. No one ever measures. No one ever tests.
So we're just guessing at it, really.
Pretty much, yeah. It's not an unreasonable guess, but it's a guess.
And what agency did you say is tasked with the responsibility for protecting American citizens against the dangers of toxic agents like tributyltin?
Well, that agency would be the Environmental Protection Agency.
EPA. Okay. The
EPA.
Okay. All right. So is it possible to measure excreted tributyltin or a metabolite of it in urine to determine if people are being exposed to it or not?
Sure.
But no one's doing this?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay, so now we're going to start a new test. People are going to walk into their doctors and want to be tested for tributyltin very shortly.
Right. Every time I see Antonia Califat at the Centers for Disease Control, who's responsible for the program that tests chemical levels in people, it's called NHANES, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Study. I say, Antonia, TBT, it needs to be on your list. And usually she says, yeah, yeah, don't bother me. My list is already too big. And the last time I saw her, she said, well, maybe. I really like these data that you're showing, so maybe the next round we'll be able to get it in.
Wow, that is nice to hear. That is nice to hear. So, okay, so PVC is used in residential and commercial plumbing to carry what we consider clean water to faucets mm-hmm. and spigots and so on. So we could potentially be getting tributyltin from there. Are there any other – is tributyltin used in is a residual of it? Does it occur in, like, things that we use to package meats, for instance, perhaps saran wrap? I know we did shows years ago on phthalates and flexible plastics yep. and so mm-hmm. on. Do we find it in that in our food chain as well?
So because no one's measuring, it's difficult to say precisely where it is. So what I can tell you is where it might be. I can tell you that I found out from a friend of mine who runs a program in Switzerland to, I wouldn't say regulate food additives, but she's in the head of the Food Packaging Council in Switzerland. And she told me that tributyltin is licensed for use in food contact materials in the U.S. as a fungicide in adhesives.
Mm.
Yeah, so that means that it could be yes. in cans and things like that at the place where they're stuck together.
This is very troublesome. Here's what we need to do. We need to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk about how tributyltin may be an obesogen. We're talking right now with Dr. Bruce Blumberg about the exposure to tributyltin, and we're going to talk about its transgenerational epigenetic effects when we get back, folks. You know that we talk about this stuff all the time, dioxins and so on and so forth. Even if you don't suffer any maladies from its exposure, especially if you're a woman, it can affect your germline, and that means your children and their grandchildren and their grandchildren right up the line will be affected by these things today. This is really important stuff, folks. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This time of year, it seems everyone's sick. You need to do everything you can to avoid it. A healthy immune system starts with a healthy lifestyle. This includes Altrient C. Altrient C delivers the vitamin C your body needs. In fact, Altrient delivers 200% more vitamin C than pills or powders. Go to AltrientC.com. That's AltrientC.com. It even comes with a money-back guarantee. For vitamin C that actually gets absorbed, go to AltrientC.com or call 888-437-6353 to order. That's 888-437-6353. Altrient C, 21st century vitamin C.
There are a few products that I believe in the way I believe in CanSee eye drops. I've been using CanSee for 6 months now, and the changes in my vision are nothing short of amazing. My near vision has improved, and I can read small print from 8 inches. My overall vision is clearer, and the glare from oncoming headlights doesn't bother me any longer. Just 1 to 2 drops a day, and the results are visible. You can find CanSee eye drops at wisechoicemedicine.net or call 800-861-4936. That's 800-861-4936. WiseChoiceMedicine.net. CanSee Eye Drops. The name says it all.
Orbit Nutrition carries over 1,000 of the hottest nutritional supplements, performance enhancers, and nutraceuticals on the planet. And now, Superhuman Radio listeners get an additional 5% off their everyday low prices by using the coupon code SHR5. That's SHR and the number 5. Choose from products like Quest Protein Bars, iForce Nutrition, Iron Mag Labs, and more. Check out Orbit's daily deals for special insane blowout prices. Log on to the Orbit Nutrition Forum and get feedback about the products you're shopping for and get an additional 5% off using the coupon code SHR5. Orbit Nutrition. Fast, reliable, competitive, international. Why shop anywhere else?
Usually something for nothing is worth nothing, but go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad to get a 1-year Life Extension Foundation membership free, plus a $25 product credit. So what does that buy you? Cutting edge information, knowledgeable health advice, huge discounts on blood tests and supplements. Want to stay younger and healthier longer? Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad and become a Life Extension member now. No cost, no obligation, no kidding.
Never before has an anti-estrogen been so powerful. The triazole formula is built on a potent all-natural aromatase inhibitor called Pizole, which has been shown in clinical trial to be as effective as a leading prescription aromatase inhibitor. Pizole works in concert with the rest of the triazole formula to control estrogen while simultaneously boosting testosterone significantly. In fact, one of triazole's testers had a 120% increase in total testosterone and a 257% increase in free testosterone. Triazole is available at bodybuilding.com, NutriPlanet.com, or where finer supplements are sold. For more information, check out GetDS.com.
Have you ever been let down by so-called nitric oxide muscle pump products before? Well, prepare to be shocked. Vengeance is like nothing you've ever tried before. Vengeance leverages several different scientifically proven technologies to deliver what some users say are painfully explosive pumps. If you are satisfied with nitric oxide products that make you wonder if they're working, move on. But if you want a muscle pump that you'll not only feel, but others will see, train with a vengeance. Go to xfmuscle.com today and get vengeance.
Jump and higher, left and more. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're talking with Dr. Bruce Blumberg from University of California at Irvine about their recent research into fetal exposure to tributyltin and how it's linked to obesity in the offspring of the rodents that they studied. So, okay, while the tributyltin may not show up in the host, so to speak, the individual being exposed to it, clearly there are changes that occur in the offspring. What did you find that make it a concerning obesogen to you?
So the experiment we did is we treated pregnant mice with low levels of tributyltin in the drinking water. And we tested three doses, and the doses we tested were 50 times lower than the NOEL, which I talked about in the last segment, 5 times lower than the NOEL, and 2 times higher. What we found is that all doses cause the offspring to get fatter, to have bigger fat depots, to have bigger fat cells, to have more fat cells, to have a population of stem cells that was predisposed to make fat cells instead of bone cells. And also these animals had fatty livers.
Oh my God.
And this happened in the exposed offspring and their children and their grandchildren, so the so-called F1, F2, F3 generation.
See, and this is the scary thing. When we start talking about transgenerational effects, no one really gives a lot of thought to this. And this, as you pointed out, your words, not mine, during the pre-interview, this is a game changer. This changes the discussion completely because now we're not talking about what it's doing to us. But we're talking about what it's going to do 3, 4, 5 generations up the road, and we don't know that it's ever going to get washed out. We it may be there forever and every generation forward, right?
That's correct. I wouldn't say use the word washed out, though, right? Because the chemical is long gone. The chemical.
Well,
I meant the effects.
I mean, when I said washed out, I mean the effects of it. These obesogenic effects that we're seeing. So we could have.
Yes.
10 generations forward having a greater degree of propensity to be obese because of their, you know, 10 generations back being exposed to it.
That's correct. So I think that changes the nature of the debate. Right now, what happens is industry says, well, you know, you guys really haven't proven any adverse harm, and our experiments say there's not really any adverse consequences. And even if there are, you just reduce exposure and then there won't be a problem because toxicology is all about dose makes the poison. And those of us with a background in endocrinology say, no, that's not the way it is at all. The dose doesn't necessarily make the poison. But you can see lots of effects where the effects do not exactly follow the dose. Nature is not linear.
Well, and as you point out, 50 times below the NOEL
exactly.
is you know, that says something right there. That's like a really small dose.
And given orally, too. So the way that you and I would encounter it.
Yeah, right, exactly. Does the first pass through the liver actually play a role in the changes in hepatic landscape?
You mean does metabolism have
in the host itself? Yeah, is there a chance that it is contributing to our obesogenic problem today as opposed to just our offspring?
Well, the data from mice and rats say that if you expose adults to tributyltin, they'll get fatter.
See? Yeah.
And we have a diabetes drug that acts precisely the same way on the same receptor, PPAR gamma. And that diabetes drug is called Avandia. And it's actually been black labeled in the U.S. for a different reason.
I was going to say.
But Avandia makes people fat.
Right.
You take it, you get fat. It makes you insulin sensitive, which is good, but it makes you fat, which is bad. So we've done the experiment. We know that chemicals that act the same way as tributyltin make people fat. So if a drug makes someone fat, why would you imagine that a chemical that works in exactly the same way wouldn't have exactly the same effect?
Okay, you are part of the scientific community. When you see this sort of stuff, it has to both upset you and perhaps even scare you. I mean, you have children, you have grandchildren, and so on. When you see this sort of stuff and you bring it to the forefront, maybe I'm naive. Don't you expect people to act faster on this sort of stuff?
It would be nice if they did.
Well, defend them. Is it because, look, you can't just stop a speeding train? You got to slow it down first. We have to find, you know, something to replace it with. We have to satisfy industry. We have to do this. We have to do that.
Yeah.
Or doesn't the safety of the population come first?
So you're exactly right. Here's something very strange in the law that I'd like to point out. So in the civil law, you know, you break a contract, you smack somebody upside the head, something like that. The standard of proof in the civil law is preponderance of the evidence, right? So you need to show that it's more likely than not that the plaintiff prevails over the defendant.
Right.
In the criminal law, we have beyond a reasonable doubt is the standard. So the standard of proof is that you need to show something beyond the doubt that a reasonable person would have looking at that set of data. For some reason, the unspoken standard in the chemical law seems to be beyond the remotest shadow of a doubt. And I don't know where that standard came from. And that's the problem here.
Yeah.
Federal agencies, like EPA, is required to have data that shows by an astronomical difference that this effect is real. And I don't know why that standard exists. Preponderance of the evidence should be sufficient. That's
well,
the law.
Well, and also, when it comes to human life, to err on the side of caution seems to be the logical thing to do. Like, you know, we've had this discussion about genetically modified. Okay, maybe GMO corn is not so bad for you, but should the American population be the test subjects? So you would think that to err on the side of caution is to say, look, here's a reasonable question about this particular thing, tributyltin. So what we need to do in the short term is we need to wind it down till we figure it out. And then if it turns out that it was all good, then we wind it back up again. But in the meantime, mm-hmm. job one has to be to protect the population. That is why these organizations were created in the first place. The EPA, the FDA, the these organizations was created so that hucksters and scamsters wouldn't kill large-scale groups of people or poison them to sell their products. So why isn't it working like that, Dr. Blumberg?
I agree with you 100%. There's different perspectives on why that is. So if you talk to someone who's actually worked at EPA, they will tell you that there's good people there and they want to protect the public health, and they're hamstrung by the law the way it's written. If you talk to people outside the EPA who deal with them, they see a tremendous amount of inertia. They see a lot of influence of the industries being regulated.
Bingo.
They see lots of things that ought to be different than how they are.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the actual truth is. I think it's some combination of all of those. The law is completely screwed up. I think since TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, was passed, only 5 chemicals have ever been taken off the market as a result of it.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's almost none. And the reason is because the standard is so high. And other sillinesses are built into the law. Like, you have to show that the effect of a chemical gives a linear dose response. So that means as you start from some level, the more you add, the more effect you get. Nature does not work that way.
Yeah.
The only one thing that works that way is poisoning.
Yeah.
Right, so toxicity, gross, unspecific toxicity, works exactly that way. There's some level where you don't have any effect, and you give more and more, and you poison more and more of the people until you eventually kill everything.
What do you want both clinicians, practitioners, and the lay public to take away from this research? What is your hope to stimulate from this research? Because obviously it causes a bit of angst, because now we have yet one more thing to worry about coming in contact with. Is your hope that we find an answer, that we eliminate it? What's your hope?
There's a couple things here. One is that people will act on their own. So government will do what they do, regulatory agencies, and you can expect that whatever they do, it's going to be much slower than needs to be done. That's the way they operate. In the meanwhile, we individuals can take steps to protect our health. You can get plastic out of your life as much as possible. You can get prepared packaged foods out of your life as much as possible.
Right.
You can eat organic as much as possible, as much as you're able.
Right. Right.
Breathe clean air, drink clean water. That will go a long way towards protecting your health. I think in the long run, what we need to do is get safe chemicals on the market. And I'm involved with a group of people that do that. There's a linkage that's happened recently. Cheryl Watson is also part of this group, to link environmental health scientists with green chemists, to teach the chemist how to make chemicals that are inherently without hazard.
I like that.
And if they do that, then we don't need to worry about government doing their job or not, because the marketplace will do the job. If somebody makes a replacement for thermal paper that doesn't have endocrine disrupting properties, it's going to immediately overwhelm the market. It's going to sweep the bad compounds right out of use.
Right, because I agree with you, and I say this all the time. I have a scientist come on with groundbreaking research like this, and their hope is to get legislators to pay attention. I say that's a waste of time. The best thing you can do is go on every radio show and every TV show you can and let every person know about it, because we vote with our dollars every single day.
Exactly.
And if something sits on the shelf, the manufacturer either goes out of business or changes the way they do business. And getting them to change the way they do business sometimes is a bottom-up approach, at least when it's these types of things. If you start avoiding these things and you're vocal about why you're avoiding it, that will end up in some focus group, which will determine the next product that they come out with, and the next product they come out with won't have this in it. One other thing I want to mention, contributor to our show, Adele Musa, who has a fantastic blog called Subversity.com, just posted Saturday about fighting to stay lean, and he listed a host, 20 natural things, including like vitamin A, real vitamin A, that actually affect PPAR gamma in the opposite direction. So if you are worried about your exposure to tribulatin and you're looking for some sort of prophylactic to maybe help you in the meantime while you rid your body, go to subversity.com and read the 20 natural agents that affect PPAR gamma in the beneficial way to help you reduce body fat. Listen, Dr. Blumberg, I want to thank you for coming on the show, and I want to thank you for doing this kind of work, because I'm sure that this makes you unpopular and makes it hard for you to get funding.
Funding is pretty decent right now, I have to say, so I'm not so concerned about that. If I had to depend on certain government agencies for funding, it might not be the case, but
right,
there are government agencies who are interested in getting to the root of the problem.
Well, bravo. I commend them, and I commend you, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're welcome.
All right, so stay tuned. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this discussion as we talk about a well-known endocrine disruptor, which is BPA, and its soon-to-be replacement with Dr. Cheryl Watson. So we'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio.
Check this out.
USA is the best whey protein in the world. Not only is it from Amish grass-fed cows inside the United States, but it's the only grass-fed whey in the world that is not heat pasteurized. Don't be fooled by other grass-fed whey products that are low heat pasteurized. Only the patented Chill-Rite process leaves all the natural fractions of whey intact to boost your immune system while building more muscle. And Whey Natural USA is also the lowest price for non-heat pasteurized grass-fed whey protein in the world. Don't waste your time on products that only deliver 15 grams of protein per scoop scoop. Choose the best with 25 grams of protein per scoop. Whey Natural USA. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Whey Natural USA banner ad today to see why anything less is wasting your money. Calling all men. The Men's Stack is here from Muscle Gauge Nutrition. The Men's Stack will give you the energy you need to train harder and the materials you need to build new muscle. The Men's Stack includes American Protein Isolate, Stimulant-Free Pre-Workout Alpha Rage, Muscle Pump Activator, L-Arginine, AKG, and Multivitamin Plus Minerals specifically formulated for men. Now, Superhuman Radio listeners can get this Men's Stack for just $99 and free shipping while supplies last. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Muscle Gauge banner ad today.
This time of year, it seems everyone's sick. You need to do everything you can to avoid it. A healthy immune system starts with a healthy lifestyle. This includes Altrient C. Altrient C delivers the vitamin C your body needs. In fact, Altrient delivers 200% more vitamin C than pills or powders. Go to altrientc.com. That's altrientc.com. It even comes with a money-back guarantee. For vitamin C that actually gets absorbed, go to altrientc.com or call 888-437-6353 to order. That's 888-437-6353. Altrient C. 21st century vitamin C.
Wherever you call your battlefield, after each training engagement, you must recover. Introducing the most complete all-natural and organic recovery formula, AM Nutrition's Basic Training, formulated by a military veteran. Basic Training provides the ammunition your body needs to recover and continue the fight. No fake sugar or flavors, no GMOs, less than 1 milligram of sugar and soy per serving, with complete nutrition no other company provides. Arm yourself with the healthiest recovery formula on the market, the body's ammunition. AM Nutrition. Join the nutritional revolution by going to muscleamnutrition.com. That's muscle, AMNUTRITION.com.
Recover!
AM Nutrition. New from Rob Ragish, author of The Blueprint and SHR's own Blueprint Power Hour, comes The Blueprint Bulletin. Every month, Rob delivers the absolute latest and greatest information right to your inbox. Everything's on the table, including training, diet, supplementation, gray market products, and more. This is a fantastic way to stay one step ahead of your competition and use these secrets to up your game. Go to theblueprintbulletin.com or click the Blueprint Bulletin banner ad on superhumanradio.com to get your free introductory issue. Go to the blueprintbulletin.com today.
Thousands of Superhuman Radio listeners already know how well GLC 2000 works at repairing joints and cartilage, and it's the best price on the market, milligram for milligram. Now GLC Direct is offering a special that my listeners can take advantage of. Buy one, get one free of any GLC 2000 product. That's right, buy one of your favorite GLC 2000 products and get one free. Capsules or raw powder. Just mention Superhuman Radio and buy one, get one free today. Call 866-452-3473 or click the GLC banner ad on superhumanradio.com. Offer limited to one per household.
Your radio just got ripped. It's Superhuman Radio.
Okay, was geht ab? Guten Morgen, es ist 7:30.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. Okay. The discussion continues as we invite Dr. Cheryl Watson. How are you doing, Dr. Watson?
Great. How are you today?
Fantastic. We're going to talk about BPA and its substitutes that seem to be on the horizon right now. For those who aren't aware, let's just real quickly cover a couple things here. BPA is considered an endocrine disruptor, correct?
Correct.
And if it could be associated with one hormone or another, it is estrogenic in nature. Is that correct?
That's what we've studied mostly, although I think I've seen some other hormones also implicated. It seems to be mainly estrogenic.
Okay. And it's found in plastics, but I've never been clear on why BPA is in plastic. Do you know why?
Why it's in plastics, I think it was just developed as something that polymerized well and had good characteristics as a plastic. I'm sure there were many different kinds of compounds tested. So it was selected on the basis of its making a good, durable, and cheap to produce plastic. I don't think anybody was thinking.
Okay, I didn't know if it was. I didn't know if it was something that was added to plastics to give it a special characteristics, like phthalates make plastics more flexible, for instance. So the higher the flexibility of the plastic, the higher the degree of phthalates that you would find in it. So I didn't know how that came about. So
it's true that a lot of plastics are mixtures today. So there's actually several kinds of things in a lot of products.
Okay, so we've become aware to some degree of BPA, and everybody's looking for the BPA-free sticker or calling to find out if BPA is in a plastic bottle that they're using for their water and so on and so forth. And as we move away from BPA, as usually happens, the industries find replacements for these things. And so these new BPA replacements are on the horizon, and one of them, I guess, is called BPS. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So what exactly is the difference between BPA and BPS, first of all?
Well, in the middle of the molecule, it has a sulfur instead of a carbon. And so it's actually very similar looking to BPA.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they picked it is because physical studies showed that it leached out of the plastic that they made it into less readily than BPA. The problem is that even if it leaches out less readily, so there's less of it contaminating your drink, for instance, in a bottle, if it's potent, that is, it acts at very, very tiny amounts, then it's still a problem.
Right. As we're finding out in the interview before with tributyltin, even 50 times less than the Noal still caused transgenerational epigenetic effects in the rodent model studies. So what we're learning is that, you know, almost any amount of some of these agents pose a risk to humans, correct?
Actually, they're just like hormones. Hormones also act at incredibly low levels. So the fact that they mimic hormones, I guess it's not so surprising that they also act at very low concentrations.
Now, what are some of the problems that occur from these typical endocrine disruptors like BPA and probably BPS as well? Do they cause specific diseases? Have they been associated specifically with the outbreak of certain outcomes?
BPA, which has been studied for a much longer period of time, certainly has been associated with diseases like reproductive failure of various kinds, diabetes, asthma, changes in prostate, behavioral changes. So we know that because it's been around long enough and people have been studying it long enough that we've been able to accumulate that really hard-to-get human data about what it does. BPS, not very long.
Right, and so even in low doses, we expect to some degree to see some of these same effects. And interestingly enough, Adele Moussa sent me a study this morning. I don't see a date on it, but it looks like it's relatively new. Disruption of reproductive aging in female and male rats by gestational exposure to estrogenic endocrine disruptors, which obviously if you're a mom and you're carrying a baby and you're drinking or coming in contact with these types of even low-level endocrine disruptors, they will affect your offspring. So while the discussion about BPA and potentially BPS is about what it can do to the host, we have to recognize that these compounds probably have transgenerational epigenetic effects as well, even though they may not have been well studied yet.
Sure, and one of the most vulnerable periods is that time perinatally, either just before or during gestation and just after birth. Those are really sensitive windows for actions of some of these things.
So what can we do? You know, obviously, the organizations that provide oversight, the government agencies that provide oversight to the companies that manufacture these products, have to be aware of this type of research, but yet they live under this mantra, well, a little bit won't hurt you, or the poison is in the dose type of an attitude. What can we do? Can we already start talking about BPS so that they don't even start introducing it into products? Or is it going to be, they love just changing the names of things and reintroducing them, and you don't even know what it is.
Well, the first thing we have to really focus on is the fact that these compounds don't have really predictable dose response curves. And we've only recently, I guess, acknowledged that because our assays have become much more sensitive and we've been able to look at much wider concentration ranges to study the effects. And if you don't have a predictable dose response curve, that means you have to study all the doses that people are and animals are possibly exposed to. And so that's a really big job, so many chemicals to test. But I heard that Dr. Blumberg, your previous guest, talked about an organization that we both belong to. We think that the secret to managing this in the future is for chemists and biologists to get together at the outset when they design chemicals and figure all of this out before anything ever gets developed into a product.
Yeah, and I would hope that that can actually happen. But that will only happen if there is no financial weight to industry. This is the problem. The problem is that profits win out over people's health, and we've seen this since the beginning of time. This is nothing new to our current situation. This has been going on forever. So you know, I want to be optimistic. But I also believe that the end result, as we talked about earlier too, that, you know, I have to bang this drum again, is in people's hands to now be wise about BPS and start calling the manufacturers of your products now that say they're BPA free and say, hey, are you planning on using BPS? Because if you are, we're not going to buy this anymore.
Well, you know, there are other things that are very expensive for manufacturers, and that is things like lawsuits and endless tests of things.
So,
you know, I think that it would be in their best interest to also find out which chemicals are likely to cause these problems down the road, because they don't want to have lawsuits. They don't want to eventually have to retool everything. So it's better for everybody, except maybe the lawyers, that we find these things out at the very, very beginning. And chemists that we've been talking to are actually, they like this idea too. It reduces their vulnerability to accusations of producing toxic chemicals. So it should be, if viewed in the right frame of mind, win-win-win.
Yeah, and you know, and the other thing is this, and you know, it's funny. So when I think about government agencies, when I think about chemists, right, I think about these sinister people. But the reality is they're people just like us. And while they may be tied into a position by the corporate structure and or legal structure in the case of government agencies, they are real people who also worry about their children and grandchildren. So by correcting these problems, it's not like as though, well, they lose and we win. We all win, including their great-grandchildren as well.
Right. And, you know, one of the impediments to this is our educational system that teaches people in these different disciplines, in these silos, that never talk to people in other disciplines. And so one of the tenets of this group is to get chemists and biologists talking with each other and, in fact, cross-training their trainees at the very, very beginning so that we're aware of the problems that have been elucidated by each of those different disciplines, and we work together to try to solve those problems really early in the game.
And I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second before we go into the break, right? So industry is going to say, look, if we have to make products that are completely harmless on every plane, in every way, we won't be able to make any products anymore. You know, you there's got to be some, you know, little bit of this, a little bit of that in products in order for us to manufacture them. And you would say in return?
Why don't we understand from the get-go what the magnitude of these problems are, and then we can make intelligent, informed choices.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So choose our battle, so to speak. What can we live with, and what can we not live with? No pun intended. I like that.
Right, and no surprises 20 years down the line.
Yeah. That's hard, by the way. Anyway, because what we're learning about transgenerational epigenetics now is just startling most people, I think. All right, let's do this. Let's take a quick commercial break, and when we come back, we're going to pick it up. We're talking with Dr. Cheryl Watson from University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston about BPA and its upcoming substitutes that you need to be aware of. You're listening to Superhuman Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
you want to outlast, outmuscle, and outperform your competition with a high-powered, stimulant-free carbohydrate source that has zero sugars, you want Carbolin. Carbolin is the original high-performance fuel that will allow you to load your muscles with glycogen in minutes instead of hours. As a pre, intra, and post-training supplement, it will give you a hardness and fullness to your muscles like you've never felt before. As an endurance supplement, Carbolin has been proven to increase VO2 max by 2.8%. If you want fast absorption and sustained energy without bloating or cramping, get Carbolin. Go to AAEFX.com today. Power Block dumbbells can replace up to 55 pairs of dumbbells in the space of just one pair, and they come in all sizes to meet the needs of all lifters, as small as 2.5 to 20 pounds per hand, all the way up to 175 pounds per hand, and everything in between. Check out the new Power Block barbells that turn your Power Block dumbbells into barbells in seconds, replacing up to 45 barbells. Or try the new kettlebell handle to convert Power Block dumbbells to kettlebells. Call 800-651-1937 or click the banner ad on superhumanradio.com for a free brochure. Everyone wants growth hormone because growth hormone works. Now AgeForce is offering a buy one, get one free on their most popular transdermal patch. The Power Patch contains 25 milligrams of real somatropin per patch. It delivers real competent human growth hormone right to your bloodstream without the discomfort of injections. There's never been a better time to see what the Power Patch can do for you. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the AgeForce banner ad today. This offer ends soon. Get your growth hormone the AgeForce way. Power Patch.
No other peptide supplier has a more complete offering than Southern Research Companies. And no other peptide supplier can boast that all their research peptides are manufactured inside the United States in Tier 1 labs. Whether you're looking for IGF-1 Long R3, GHRP6, GHRP2, Melanotan 2, Mechano Growth Factor, or PT-141, or hard-to-find peptides like Triptorelin or Follistatin, you'll find them at Southern Research Companies. Free shipping on orders over $150. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Southern Research banner ad today and do business with the most trusted name in research peptides, Southern Research Companies.
Electronic muscle stimulation is state-of-the-art for pain management and muscle recovery. Now from ABC Medical comes the Pain Pod. Pain Pod is a professional strength EMS unit and provides 12 therapeutic modes and 20 intensity settings. It comes with everything you need. Small, convenient, rechargeable, and portable. But make no mistake, Pain Pod delivers commercial-grade strength for immediate pain relief. The Pain Pod normally sells for $349, but for a limited time, the Superhuman Nation can get the Pain Pod for only $200, including shipping. Pain Pod comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Pain Pod banner ad today to learn more.
Eat dessert again with the new 100% natural line of high-protein, low-carb Quest protein bars. I love lemon cream pie and strawberry cheesecake, but you can choose from chocolate peanut butter, coconut cashew, or cinnamon roll as well. No matter which one you try, you'll feel like you're eating dessert. But this is no ordinary dessert. With 20 grams of high-quality whey protein isolate, 17 grams of prebiotic fiber, and sweetened with stevia, these bars will make you feel like you're cheating, but you're not. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad to learn more about these clean and delicious protein bars.
Build muscle, burn fat. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is a very, very important discussion, Dr. Watson, because, you know, we, and I always feel snookered, to be honest with you, because organizations like the Food and Drug Administration will continually allow product manufacturers to play the old switcheroo on American people, you know, change the name. In fact, on this weekend, Casual Friday show, we're going to be talking about a drug that was given to women for to avoid miscarriages that was taken off the market because it was linked to birth defects. And now, after looking at it again, they're saying, well, maybe that didn't cause the birth defects. So they're going to allow the pharmaceutical company to reintroduce it. But here's the problem I have. They're not going to change.
Is this diethylstilbestrol?
No, I wish. No, I hope it's not. Well, we've done shows on that already. But I just hope that it's not. What I'm upset about is that they're going to let the manufacturer change the name. And I say, look, use the same name that it was marketed under originally, so people can go, wait a minute, there may be a risk of birth defects. Let me make informed decisions. But what the FDA does and EPA and these other organizations is they allow manufacturers to change the name so that they can snooker us and get it under the. So what other compounds are out there like BPA and soon BPS that are similar to these that we need to be aware of?
Well, there certainly have been a whole range of compounds that have been tweaked slightly that are plastics that we haven't. I haven't yet seen information about the other substitutes, but I'm sure that they're not long after this. I think part of the problem with the regulatory agency is the sheer volume of the compounds and the concentrations of these compounds, and what's even more frightening, the mixtures of these compounds that we're exposed to, that it's just an awful lot of data to be very up on, to understand how they work and how they work in combinations. So I guess one of the tenets of this group that Dr. Blumberg and I belong to is that it takes an awful lot of information that is legally admissible to run a regulatory agency. But we would like to get ahead of that game and not be part of the regulatory system, but simply provide information so that people might pretest these compounds before we ever get into the regulatory domain. And we're hoping that that might speed things up a little bit and maybe reduce some of this huge burden they have for testing so many compounds and maybe sometimes even figuring out that it's the same thing with a different name.
Right, right. And I like that idea of teaching the chemists better ways to make things that don't cross into this area, because then you really are at domino one. If they're following certain guidelines to exclude certain things like endocrine disruptors from manufacturing, then we never even get into this debate, because it's not being presented to the FDA or the EPA, and they're not having to scratch their head and go, okay, what do we do now? Do we approve this? Do we not approve it? You know.
And then they saved themselves a lot of trouble too, you know, because we figured this out at the beginning based on the collaboration of biologists and chemists, which we're not used to doing very much yet.
Yeah. So in your recent article that you published, what are you hoping that both clinicians and lay people take away from this, other than stay away from plastic? I have to be honest with you. I'm at a point in my life right now where I really feel like the best solution is to stay away from plastic. What do I replace my water bottle with, a glass one or a bladder from a goat? You know, what do I do, you know?
Well, what I replaced mine with was a glass one or a stainless steel one. But sometimes you have to be worried about what they're putting as coatings on those.
Yes, that's
anyway,
right.
Because, you know, manufacturers report to us the ingredients in the things that we consume, but they rarely report to us the ingredients in the bottle that the food or beverage is in. So it's really just very, very hard to know is one of the problems. And, for instance, just the whole idea of announcing that things are BPA-free, I was immediately suspicious, but that in and of itself is an example of not telling you what is in it as opposed to what isn't in it.
Yeah, and what did they replace the BPA with? Because you have to assume that if they take a chemical out that gives plastic a certain characteristic, they have to replace that chemical with a similar chemical that then replaces that characteristic. And one,
right,
just by applying critical thinking, would think that it must be similar, and if it's similar, it must have some of the same dangers.
Perhaps, yes. And so we have to get more in the vein of testing for that before we launch it onto the public.
You know, I just had a thought. It's funny, I said this on a couple minutes ago, and then I thought about it. That's not a bad idea. I remember being I'm 54 now. I remember being a teenager, and I remember, you know, it was really cool to go to a concert with one of those suede-covered pouches filled with sangria or something in it.
Uh-huh.
And back in the day, they were actually made out of animal bladders. And I thought, you know, maybe we need a kind of renaissance to occur to eliminate some of these modern entrapments that are poisoning us. Maybe we need somebody to start making those bladder bags again so that we can carry our water in them instead. But then you know what the problem is? The way they tan them and cure them will be, well, the chemicals in that are residual, blah, blah, blah.
So yeah. There's no way out of it sometimes. I don't know.
But the problem with that is that you probably can't patent an animal bladder. And so, therefore, industry may not be as interested in it.
But you know what? There's going to come a day where patentability is meaningless. And that's the, when people start turning to products that make sense. And I just had this thought. It's funny you should say that. Last week, I was thinking, why won't one of the big pharma companies get behind the production of bioidentical hormones? Instead, they keep going for these easily patentable, you know, molecularly Frankenstein approaches. And if a big company would just get behind and go, okay, you know, that's fine. We're not going to make billions, but we're going to guarantee good quality control on this unpatentable thing. People will buy it. They'll make the money anyway.
I guess that's that would be the enlightened point of view, but yes. I don't think people will make nearly as big a bucks on something that they can't patent and therefore have exclusive rights on.
Yeah. No, and you're
because everybody
you're
right. else can produce it as well if it's not patented.
No, you're absolutely right. A case in point was BASF had developed R alpha lipoic acid as a anti-diabetes drug. I call it diabetes drug. Yeah. And when they found out that it was naturally occurring and they couldn't patent it, they abandoned it, even though it worked so well and had no negative side effects.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah, it's very, very sad. Okay, so.
Yeah, so industry is driving, the profitability is driving what we're being allowed as options.
Yeah, and it's very, very sad. It really is. Well, I applaud you bringing this stuff to the forefront because while it doesn't necessarily give us answers, what it does do is make us more aware that, hey, it's just a shell game. Don't be lulled into thinking that something is BPA-free. Now you have to ask more questions. Well, what was the BPA replaced with? Mm-hmm. And if it's BPS, I say personally, this is not you, this is me, run for the hills. Don't use it. That's it.
And it gives us the option, it gives us the knowledge and the techniques to say it's possible to test these things. We're now developing a range of sensitive assays. So let's get at a different place in the process and get them tested.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Listen, I want to thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today, Dr. Watson.
Well, I thank you very much for your interest in this.
Yeah, keep fighting the good fight. We keep talking about it here. You know, A lot of people in media, they cover these stories as they come up here and there, and we constantly talk about this stuff because you cannot talk about it often enough because we are being bombarded. There are things we haven't even had a chance to talk about yet because we don't know about them that we'll find out about in years and months to come. We have to understand that when it comes to especially plastics, using plastics to contain foods and beverages is not a wise thing. I mean, you know, we're talking about BPA, BPS. There's phthalates. There's all these other things in there that we don't even know about that act like hormones. And years from now, we'll find out about them. So I say avoid plastics until manufacturers can prove to us they can produce plastics that don't damage us, period. And, you know,
it's extremely important for us to have this conversation with the public.
Yes, yes, because the power in the pyramid is at the bottom, and we vote every day with our dollars. And if we stop buying things, manufacturers will – I've said this before on the show. Manufacturers will sell us what they want, or they will sell us what we want. But we have to dictate that with our buying habits.
And our knowledge.
There
yes.
you go. Listen, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, take care. All right, so stay tuned. When we come back, we're going to talk about another one of my favorites, and that is melatonin and the linkage between decreased melatonin production and its linkage to a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes when we return to Superhuman Radio. Stay tuned.
Distribution. I'm like Atlanta.
Power block dumbbells.
dumbbells can replace up to 55 pairs of dumbbells in the space of just one pair. And they come in all sizes to meet the needs of all lifters, as small as 2.5 to 20 pounds per hand, all the way up to 175 pounds per hand, and everything in between. Check out the new Power Block barbells that turn your Power Block dumbbells into barbells in seconds, replacing up to 45 barbells. Or try the new kettlebell handle to convert Power Block dumbbells to kettlebells. Call 800-651-1937 or click the banner ad on superhumanradio.com for a free brochure.
You train hard. You push the limits of your body every day, and sometimes pain pushes back. Now silence your pain with Phoenix Kinetocream. Kinetocream is made using a perfect blend of natural ingredients and reduces inflammation and shuts down pain with its very first use. Listen to what one user said about Phoenix Kinetocream.
Training made me ache. My back, my shoulders, even my elbows. I rub Kinetocream on my shoulders, and in minutes, I could feel the pain go away, not covered up by that freezing feeling like other creams. The pain was gone.
You can learn more about Kinetocream by visiting PhoenixBioPerformance.com. Don't let pain slow you down. Rise above the ashes with Phoenix Kinetocream. That's PhoenixBioPerformance.com.
AnabolicMinds.com is the premier website for credible information on building muscle, burning fat, supplementation, and more. With over 100,000 active registered members and over 2.5 million posts, it's one of the largest communities on the internet to get help and answer to your question. It's also the place that the official Superhuman Radio Forum is hosted. Visit AnabolicMinds.com today and get into the action. AnabolicMinds.com. Learn, teach, lead.
Usually something for nothing is worth nothing, but go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad to get a one-year Life Extension Foundation membership free, plus a $25 product credit. So what does that buy you? Cutting-edge information, knowledgeable health advisors, huge discounts on blood tests and supplements. Want to stay younger and healthier longer? Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad and become a Life Extension member now. No cost, no obligation, no kidding.
Superhuman Radio has the smartest and most dedicated health and fitness listeners found anywhere in the world. If you're trying to tap this market of greater than 50 million health fitness consumers, you simply can't do better than advertising on Superhuman Radio. Our sponsors tell us Superhuman Radio outperforms other forms of advertising time and time again. If you're tired of wasting valuable advertising dollars and need a new way to build your client base, go to superhumanradio.com and click on the Advertise with Us link. It just may be the best thing you have ever done for your business. Way Natural USA is the best whey protein in the world. Not only is it from Amish grass-fed cows inside the United States, but it's the only grass-fed whey in the world that is not heat pasteurized. Don't be fooled by other grass-fed whey products that are low heat pasteurized. Only the patented Chill-Rite process leaves all the natural fractions of whey intact to boost your immune system while building more muscle. And Way Natural USA is also the lowest price for non-heat pasteurized grass-fed whey protein in the world. Don't waste your time on products that only deliver 15 grams of protein per scoop. Choose the best with 25 grams of protein per scoop. Way Natural USA. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Way Natural USA banner ad today to see why anything less is wasting your money.
This is the Superhuman Channel. Evolution just got kicked up a notch.
Welcome back. Okay. A favorite topic of mine, as you know, is the discussion about melatonin. So many people don't pay attention to sleep. They think it's optional, and they get diseases. My next guest is Dr. Eva Schoenhammer. She's with the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. Welcome to the show, Dr. Schoenhammer.
Thank you, Carl. Glad to be here.
Yes, and this is an important discussion. So you published a paper that says decreased melatonin secretion associated with higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes. But I have to tell you, when I started to read the paper, one of the things that I should have not been surprised by, but I was, because in so many papers about melatonin, they talk about melatonin secretion, but you lead off talking about a disruption in the receptor function, correct?
Yeah, that is correct. Well, I guess we were trying to make an opening in the paper that would sort of lead to why it could make sense potentially that melatonin is associated with type 2 diabetes at all, which may not seem so logical at first glance. And so we believe, even though none of this is set in stone, but a lot of evidence points towards that the receptors do play an important role here.
Okay. So the first question that came to mind when I started to read this, and keep in mind I'm not a scientist, so my questions are probably similar to the ones that the average person in the audience would ask, is it possible that these changes in receptor functionality are corollary to inappropriate adherence to sleep hygiene as they are to the insulin receptor? So as opposed to being causative of type 2 diabetes, they're just changing the landscape as the insulin receptor does.
Yeah, I mean, you're raising a really important question, and I can tell you know the topic a little bit. There, clearly, the way the study was conducted that you was referring to would not allow us to basically determine the direction of causality of these associations, the association between melatonin secretion and risk of type 2 diabetes or changes in receptors that would lead to type 2 diabetes. So no, we can't tell whether changes in receptor lead to differences in melatonin secretion or vice versa. But we believe, and that's mostly because there's a little bit of genetic evidence that would support that it's actually melatonin that triggers these changes in the melatonin receptors. Mm-hmm. That would subsequently induce type 2 diabetes.
The lack of melatonin, you're saying, makes these changes?
Yeah, mostly it is what we call circadian disruption that
right.
then messes up the circadian system. And because, as you know, melatonin is such a tight marker of the circadian system, will eventually lead to changes in melatonin secretion. What we are mostly worried about is a lower secretion of melatonin, because if we knew how to upregulate melatonin secretion, I bet many people would try to do that.
Can you describe the study, please?
Yes. Well, so we have been using a study that's familiar throughout the decades now. It's the Nurses' Health Study cohorts. The first one was initiated already back in 1976. So these are some of the oldest and longest running cohort studies. And essentially, when we do biomarker studies like this here, what we do is we have a really great resource. We collected blood and urine samples from within this cohort of 120,000 women, and the collection of these samples occurred 20 years ago. Essentially, now you have the opportunity to follow healthy women throughout their life and see who develops the disease that you're interested in studying and who doesn't. We were interested in women who developed type 2 diabetes over the years. And then we had a group of, in our case, this was a study of 370 women with type 2 diabetes, for whom we could now go back to the blood samples that they had provided to us 20 years ago or however many years ago, when they were still healthy, when they did not have the disease. And we can use these samples and compare them to samples of women that we also collected back then, but who over the decades did not get type 2 diabetes. So it's a really very unique resource to have, and it, as you
yeah.
can see, takes a long time to collect and to establish at the cohort study. But what it does allow you to do eventually is to then really say, well, look, this is a marker that is predictive of the disease that we're interested in. So essentially, if you're looking at melatonin collected many years before a person develops type 2 diabetes and you can link changes in melatonin to the disease, you would then move forward and say, well, hey, maybe we have a new predictive marker here for the disease that could eventually be important in clinics or in other preventive settings.
Well, and we're going to talk more about that because that's really an exciting area right there. Okay, so what did you find over these 20 years? So in other words, let's say, what was there a large percentage of women who had a low melatonin status at the baseline measurement?
Well, you know, the way we do this is for melatonin, there aren't any standards. So there is no threshold value where you would say, well, this is too low or this is now too
right,
high.
It's right.
like we have for glucose. For melatonin, we don't know what is appropriate. Essentially, then what you do is you look at all the values, and then you know the average value from these 370 women was, let's say, 50 nanograms of the metabolite. Now, you can also divide them up into three groups. The one group with a third of the women with the lower levels, then a medium level group, and the highest level group. So essentially, we call these tertiles. And it's just following the distribution of the data, taking women who fall into this lower range versus in the higher range. It's a statistical method that is very often used when you don't know exactly which values you're actually trying to get at, if
right.
there's no established standard or threshold.
It's almost like trying to come up with an epidemiological range, high and low
right.
range. So now, and you may have said this and I missed it. When the original baseline measurement was taken, where were these women in their status of menopause? Were they peri, pre, post, or none of them were even at that range yet?
Well, as it happens in this particular study, and I'm always having in mind all the many studies that we're doing, but this particular one was looking at women who were on average 64 years old, so they were post-menopause. In essence, these are older women for whom we have collected urine samples. Those are the samples that you actually need to measure melatonin. And that collection happened in 2000. So for this particular study, we have urine samples from 2000 when these women were postmenopausal,
uh-huh.
and then we followed them through 2012, so 12 years precisely, until they did or didn't develop type 2 diabetes.
Now, I'm assuming that their blood sugar levels were tested at baseline also. Did you also test for insulin levels independently of blood sugar levels?
No, we did not look at insulin levels in particular, but we do have a marker that we call insulin resistance, and that's a combination of a variety of markers that are related to later on perhaps going on to develop type 2 diabetes. And we do have a comparison of these markers, and we do see that the women with the lower melatonin levels tend to have a little bit of higher insulin resistance.
Right, right. Okay, so now fast forward 12 years.
Yes.
What did you learn from this particular group?
Well, so interestingly, if you divided up the women, as I previously described, into women, a third of them with lower levels, another third with medium-type levels of melatonin, and a group of women with higher levels of melatonin, you see that the women with the higher levels of melatonin, which is still a sizable group of 170 women in our study, have an over twofold increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes compared to the women who are sort of on the lower end of melatonin production. So in essence, what that means, every third person amongst us who is probably on the higher end or on the lower end of melatonin has a twofold increased risk of developing type 2 diabetes, and that's probably related to their melatonin levels or whatever these levels stand for, I should say.
You see, and I'm thinking, my mind is clicking right now. So I'm thinking about postmenopausal women. We know there's one thing I think we can say fairly unabashedly about postmenopausal women is they don't sleep well to begin with. They have what I would consider nighttime hypoglycemic episodes that wake them up, even if they're beyond the symptoms of postmenopause, such as hot flushes and so on. This is a group that we know complains that they just don't sleep like they used to.
Well, but I will say that that's true for men and women in this age range. You probably know that about two-thirds of individuals who are age 65 or older do have some form of sleep problem in the
yeah.
United States.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a very prevalent situation that certainly does apply also to postmenopausal women, but I would not exclude men from this.
No, and I agree. I wasn't, but and so the thing that's going through my mind is the chicken and the egg. Do they have low melatonin status because they're not sleeping well, or are they not sleeping well because they have low melatonin status? Which really is a very important thing to learn, I think.
I think that's a really, really important question. And curiously, you pick up the one question that I am sort of mulling over since almost a decade now, too. And I would love to cite a study that sort of gets at why I am concerned about the directionality
of this.
And that's a study that was published many years ago, but it was looking at centenarians, so individuals who reached the age of 100 and older. Which is a very rare sort of instance, you know, and so someone was able to collect probably 100 or so individuals, I forget the exact number, of individuals who reached this old age. And what they found, interestingly, is that in these individuals who remained healthy for such a long time, you do see their circadian rhythms being preserved and resembling that of young individuals. And so that study made me think, because most of the results we are looking at are cross-sectional, which means, you know, two factors were assessed around the same time. Do we know which one causes what? Here, you have a suggestion that perhaps melatonin or the circadian system is a marker of healthy aging, meaning that if you, through whichever means, be it remaining slim and exercising, etc., remain a healthy person, then your circadian system might also remain preserved and you do not have sleep problems, etc. So clearly, I also, you know, think we would need a long-term follow-up study where you, within the same individual, basically from birth throughout their older age, repeatedly assess their melatonin levels to be certain that truly there is a decline in melatonin level with age, regardless whether you remain healthy or not, or whether what I think is possible, all we see is that melatonin levels decline, particularly in those who are more prone to develop diseases. And so I think you are raising a really important point.
Yeah,
here.
And I see, and we know, you know, I can't help to think that. And I've thought about this same thing that you're talking about. I thought about interviewing individuals who have aged into their 8th, 9th, and 10th decade of life healthy without any real – because I suspect that one of the things that they have done is protected their sleep all that time. They got to bed. They observed a more primitive sleep cycle where they – they shut the lights off at 8:30, 9 o'clock at night and allowed the body to do what it does best before modernization took place. And they've done this for as a lifelong habit, because one of the things that I learned about 7 years ago from a woman on the West Coast named Crispin Sullivan, who did some research in Hawaii, was that when they looked at healthy individuals who were in their 8th and 9th and 10th decade of life, What they did discover about them was two things. Now, they were not looking at melatonin back then, but what they discovered was that they had optimal thyroid function and they had optimal gut microbiome with specific types of gut bacteria that were not found in the general population. Now, some people are going to think, oh, well, the answer is probiotics. No, what you need to understand is that the body prunes the flora in the gut at night when you sleep. So having a healthy gut depends on getting the proper amount and the proper type of sleep every night.
I think you are right on. And there is another layer of complication that I would like to bring up here, which is what we tend to refer to as chronotype, but perhaps people know better when you refer to it as morningness or eveningness of an individual, as we are understanding that chronotype is genetically determined more likely than anything else. We are also wondering whether when we look at morning melatonin measures, we are not really looking at the reflection of this chronotype, because obviously if you measure melatonin in the morning, you're in of someone who went very late to bed, like an evening type would have been. Levels may look very different than if you measure this melatonin in the morning of someone who had a full bed rest. So if you think about that, then you get very quickly to what you just said, because morning types, more likely because of the societal circumstances with the 9-to-5 jobs that are typically happening, have a much easier time to adjust to this without making major changes to their personal life. So they go to bed early, they wake up probably at 6 or 7 without any problems, go to work. It's very easy for them to maintain a regular lifestyle. And even if you think about families, when you have kids, evening types often have to change their chronotype, their inherent chronotype, to match the needs of the child.
Right.
If you already are a morning type, it's fairly easy to, at least, you know, not talking about disruptions of sleep at night when the baby cries, but later on, I think morning types in many ways have a major advantage in terms of maintaining regular rhythms in their lives, which are so important for healthy sleep.
This is an important discussion, because it was the industrialization of countries that changed people's adherence to their chronotype. We've actually done shows about this. Okay, look, this is going to get exciting. I love this discussion. We're talking with Dr. Eva Schoenhammer from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. We're going to get deeper into the topic as we start to traverse how decreased melatonin secretion may be associated with higher risks of developing type 2 diabetes. Stay tuned. You're listening to Superhuman Radio. We'll be right back.
Dumbbells can replace up to 55 pairs of dumbbells in the space of just one pair, and they come in all sizes to meet the needs of all lifters, as small as 2.5 to 20 pounds per hand, all the way up to 175 pounds per hand, and everything in between. Check out the new Power Block barbells that turn your Power Block dumbbells into barbells in seconds, replacing up to 45 barbells. Or try the new kettlebell handle to convert Power Block dumbbells to kettlebells. Call 800-651-1937 or click the banner ad on superhumanradio.com for a free brochure.
I usually avoid protein bars because they're generally just candy in disguise. But that's all changed now. With Quest protein bars, we can enjoy dessert again without the guilt. With 20 grams of whey isolate protein, tons of prebiotic fiber, no sugar added, and only 2 to 6 grams of active carbohydrates per bar, Quest bars will keep you full and lean. I've never endorsed a protein bar before because I simply didn't trust them. That's all changed with the Quest bar. Not just because of what's in them, but more so for what's not. Go to superhumanradio.com today and click the Quest Protein Bar banner ad. Start enjoying dessert again.
My friends are always asking me what I do to keep my face so youthful and fresh looking. I use RGCell Super Stem Cell Support. RGCell is the only cosmeceutical with penetrating anti-aging messenger molecules that activate old and dormant stem cells to restore your skin to a healthier, younger appearance. This helps to repair DNA, stimulate new cell growth, and aggressively eliminate wrinkles. You can learn more by visiting superhumanradio.com and clicking the RG Cell banner ad today.
True Protein is now TrueNutrition.com. The company that gave you personalized protein blends has now expanded their offerings to include over 5,000 new products. Whether your interests are health and fitness, sports nutrition and supplements, or fitness gear and accessories, you'll find what you're looking for at TrueNutrition.com. Check out the new vegetarian and vegan product lines as well. Oh, and don't worry, you can still blend your own personal protein supplements with a full range of milk, whey, casein, beef, egg, rice, and soy proteins. Check out TrueNutrition.com today.
Everyone wants growth hormone because growth hormone works. Now AgeForce is offering a buy one, get one free on their most popular transdermal patch. The Power Patch contains 25 milligrams of real somatropin per patch. It delivers real, competent human growth hormone right to your bloodstream without the discomfort of injections. There's never been a better time to see what the Power Patch can do for you. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the AgeForce banner ad today. This offer ends soon. Get your growth hormone the AgeForce way. Power Patch.
True Protein is now TrueNutrition.com. The company that gave you personalized protein blends has now expanded their offerings to include over 5,000 new products. Whether your interests are health and fitness, sports nutrition and supplements, or fitness gear and accessories, you'll find what you're looking for at TrueNutrition.com. Check out the new vegetarian and vegan product lines as well. Oh, and don't worry, you can still blend your own personal protein supplements with a full range of milk, whey, casein, beef, egg, rice, and soy proteins. Check out TrueNutrition.com today.
Jumping higher, lifting more. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. Okay. Dr. Schoenhammer.
Yes.
Were any of the subjects of this study asked not to supplement with melatonin?
The study, melatonin and type 2 diabetes, no. It is an observational study. So essentially, we have very little contact throughout these decades with the participants. At least individual contact is very little. No, we do not advise them to make any lifestyle changes.
Did they report any lifestyle changes? So for instance, do we know if any of these individuals were supplementing with melatonin, over-the-counter melatonin products?
Well, so look, how this works is we have asked once at least throughout these decades to kind of get a sense what the prevalence of melatonin supplementation is within the cohort. We have not followed this up regularly only because in this one-time assessment, we found that it's a really small proportion of individuals who did use melatonin supplements. And this was at a time when actually melatonin supplements were quite popular.
Right.
So we decided to no longer follow up on that question only because we need to preserve space on questionnaires, it's technical details, but we want to focus on things that are more prevalent than really rare supplement use.
Well, the only reason why I asked this, are you familiar with, there was a study that was done that has been somewhat thrown aside because it has not been reproduced. But there was a study done probably 8 to 10 years ago by the Madonna del Grazie Institute on Menopause in Italy, where they took a cohort of women who were either perimenopausal and had episodes of amenorrhea lasting a minimum of 3 months, all the way to completely postmenopause who had been amenorrheic for at least a minimum of 1 year, and asked them to take a 3-milligram tablet of melatonin and keep a diary. And I forget what period of time. Do you know what study I'm talking about, Dr.
Yes, I am a little bit familiar with this type of literature, only because we have looked also whether melatonin does affect estrogens or sex steroids more generally. Because obviously, I'm not sure whether that's what you're alluding to. But
yes, it is, because, and the reason I say, and the reason I'm asking this, these women, the largest portion of these women actually regained their menstrual cycle during the study period. And while I don't think it was the melatonin, by the way,
yes.
I think they were asked to take the melatonin at sundown. I spoke to the doctor, a very difficult discussion years ago because he didn't speak very good English. But the women were asked to take the melatonin around 8 p.m., even though they may not have gone to sleep until 10.
Yeah.
And I believe that it wasn't just the supplementation of the melatonin, but it was the adherence to what is considered normal circadian rhythm, returning it by making the melatonin pulse when it should have instead of what it had become from not adhering to day and night standards, that actually caused some of these women to reverse their amenorrheic status.
A very interesting thought, I have to say. I don't know that kind of train of thought towards altering sex steroids. There are a few studies that have looked at whether sleep sort of changes breast cancer risk, which is a cancer that's highly linked to estrogen levels. But such a direct link, I am not sure has ever been studied. It does make sense to what you're saying, and it might be interesting to conduct a study where you try to manipulate sleep and see how that affects estrogen levels in these women. I clearly think you are right on to something, because we have just completed a trial here at the Dana-Farber where we used melatonin in women to see whether if we randomized them to a supplement an hour before bedtime, whether that would alter their sex steroids. And that's thinking along the same lines, that melatonin in itself probably affects sleep and regularity of sleep, and so whether melatonin or sleep then subsequently leads to expected changes remains to be determined. But the two are really so interlinked that it will be hard to say if we do see an effect, whether it was the actual supplement or the regulation of sleep that was.
See, and this is what I suspect. What I suspect, the reason that some of this melatonin research is hard to reproduce is because melatonin production is so critically timed, endogenous melatonin production is so critically timed to sunrise and sunset that taking doses of melatonin minutes before bed, while may make the individual sleepy, are not really gaining all the benefits of melatonin supplementation. I have said this for years now, that if you really want the advantages of melatonin, find out what civilian sunset is in your area. Take it then. Take it at 8 o'clock, 7:45, 8:15, whatever it is in your area. Because what we have done as humans through electric light and computers and everything else is we have disrupted the natural dance between day and night hormones. And this changes the fingerprint, if you will, of how hormones occur. And in order to reestablish them, you have to time the melatonin supplement. You have to time
it. But I also have to complicate matters a little bit, Carl, because not only is it that you need to know when exactly you're using a melatonin supplement if you want to use exogenous melatonin, But then there are so many other questions that would need to be determined. One is we know that there's a large difference in how quickly individuals break down melatonin supplements. So some people will break down the supplement within a few hours and might not even have enough of the substrate in their circulation to last them throughout the night, whereas others may break it down so slowly that they have a hangover next morning because they're still sleepy.
You're right.
So that is an open question. And then the other question is, do you have low or high melatonin levels to begin with? Because maybe a benefit would only be seen in those who do have low melatonin levels to begin with. Whereas if you already have nice and high melatonin levels, and again, we don't even know what high means, but on the higher end for that matter, then maybe you don't need a melatonin supplement. And so it's very complicated. I think first we need to understand how endogenous melatonin functions in all its rhythmicity and affected by outside factors, etc., before we can even understand how exogenous melatonin in the form of supplements would affect the body.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I want to talk about receptors for a second, because we always talk about melatonin production. We always talk about melatonin in and of itself, and we talk about the pineal gland and the production of melatonin. But there's very little discussion about the receptors. So when I had Dr. Russell Ryder on the show, one of the numerous times he's been on the show, I asked him if he subscribed to this thought that the pineal gland atrophies over time, and through atrophication, there's a reduction in melatonin receptors in the pineal gland that then cause the reduction in melatonin production. Do you have any thoughts on that? Is it, when it comes to the receptor, what role does the receptor play in telling the pineal gland how much melatonin to produce?
So Dr. Russell is referring to a feedback mechanism, and I will defer that to him because I think he is a basic scientist who would know much better than I how these things function in animal models and in cell lines. But as far as other receptors are concerned, let's say estrogen receptors, which are much more well known because many women, if they develop breast cancer, they do have estrogen receptors in the tumor, and that makes them respond well to a hormonal treatment. So we don't know that with aging, the amount of receptor declines in this instance, which makes me wonder whether it's true. But again, I defer to Dr. Russell that the amount of receptors declines rather than perhaps the substrate that then attaches to receptor and through attaching to receptor initiates whatever, you know, mechanism or physiological function. So I would think in terms of melatonin, at least, you know, just looking at these cross-sectional studies, it looks like, I'm sure you have seen this plot, how melatonin production changes throughout the lifetime of a person. When we are born, we have pretty much no melatonin production, not even at night. You know, that production occurs primarily at night. But then at age 3 months or so, melatonin production starts to kick in. And some people have linked that to, okay, that's when the baby starts to develop a sleep rhythm, because before that, they wake up pretty much any time. Mm-hmm. So at 3 months, you start seeing them secreting melatonin, and that melatonin production increases substantially until they are about age 10 to 15.
And then it heralds puberty. It starts to drop, and then puberty onsets, right?
Yes, and then it starts dropping. So these are the studies we know. They really do suggest that there's a peak in adolescence and then a steady decline, and that never gets stopped anymore, essentially suggesting that even at age 40, most people have very little melatonin production at night, and subsequently you see all the sleep problems kicking in as people get older and older. So if that's true, then clearly, you know, that is a problem that would suggest that it's not the receptors, but the lack of melatonin that sort of hampers a variety of functions that are related to melatonin attaching to its receptor.
Well, here's an interesting twist, and then we have to take a quick commercial break. But Dr. Pope, who does a lot of research in anabolic steroids in sports, published a study. I think it was him or Dr. Bashin, but one of them published a study many years ago, probably 8-10 years ago, that showed that superphysiological doses of testosterone increased the androgen receptor biosynthesis. And so one would come away from that thinking, well, the more of a hormone you have traveling around the body, then the body increases receptors that can take advantage of that hormone. If the same was true with melatonin, then there's a really, really important area of research that needs to get to the bottom of what we were talking about before, and that is about proper supplementation that is unique to each person. Because if supplementing with melatonin can maintain healthy status of these receptors and the number of receptors, then that alone, because don't forget, the study that made everybody interested in melatonin was another study that was never reproduced, where they took the pineal glands of old rats out and put the pineal glands of young rats in, and those rats, their bodies actually started to reverse in aging, and they ended up living far longer than they should have. You remember that study? That was the one that made everybody think, oh, melatonin is the anti-aging drug of the future.
Yeah, you do have a point, and I will speak more to it after the break.
Okay, let's do this. Let's take this commercial break. We'll be right back with more Superhuman Radio. Stay tuned.
Everyone wants growth hormone because growth hormone works. Now, AgeForce is offering a buy one, get one free on their most popular transdermal patch. The Power Patch contains 25 milligrams of real somatropin per patch. It delivers real, competent human growth hormone right to your bloodstream without the discomfort of injections. There's never been a better time to see what the Power Patch can do for you. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the AgeForce banner ad today. This offer ends soon. Get your growth hormone the AgeForce way. Power Patch.
This time of year, it seems everyone's sick. You need to do everything you can to avoid it. A healthy immune system starts with a healthy lifestyle. This includes Altrian C. Altrian C delivers the vitamin C your body needs. In fact, Altrian delivers 200% more vitamin C than pills or powders. Go to AltrianC.com. That's AltrianC.com. It even comes with a money-back guarantee. For vitamin C that actually gets absorbed, go to AltriantC.com or call 888-437-6353 to order. That's 888-437-6353. Altriant C, 21st century vitamin C.
My friends are always asking me what I do to keep my face so youthful and fresh looking. I use RG Cell Super Stem Cell Support. RG Cell is the only cosmeceutical with penetrating anti-aging messenger molecules that activate old and dormant stem cells to restore your skin to a healthier, younger appearance. This helps to repair DNA, stimulate new cell growth, and aggressively eliminate wrinkles. You can learn more by visiting superhumanradio.com and clicking the RG Cell banner ad today.
Orbit Nutrition carries over 1,000 of the hottest nutritional supplements, performance enhancers, and nutraceuticals on the planet. And now, Superhuman Radio listeners get an additional 5% off their everyday low prices by using the coupon code SHR5. That's SHR and the number 5. Choose from products like Quest Protein Bars, iForce Nutrition, Iron Mag Labs, and more. Check out Orbit's daily deals for special insane blowout prices. Log on to the Orbit Nutrition Forum and get feedback about the products you're shopping for, and get an additional 5% off using the coupon code SHR5. Orbit Nutrition. Fast, reliable, competitive, international. Why shop anywhere else?
Iron Mag Labs is the leading supplement company offering the most hardcore pro-anabolic supplements. Visit IronMagLabs.com and check out our top-selling products. Asta RX, Halo Extreme, Sinustane RX, E-Control RX, Decadrol Max, Ultra Male RX. Iron Mag Labs makes supplements that actually work. No hype, no BS, just real results. There's a reason you keep hearing about Iron Mag Labs. Come see what you're missing. Visit Iron Mag Labs at IronMagLabs.com for the most hardcore bodybuilding supplements.
Whey Natural USA is the best whey protein in the world. Not only is it from Amish grass-fed cows inside the United States, but it's the only grass-fed whey in the world that is not heat pasteurized. Don't be fooled by other grass-fed whey products that are low heat pasteurized. Only the patented Chill-Rite process leaves all the natural fractions of whey intact to boost your immune system while building more muscle. And Whey Natural USA is also the lowest price for non-heat pasteurized grass-fed whey protein in the world. Don't waste your time on products that only deliver 15 grams of protein per scoop. Choose the best with 25 grams of protein per scoop. Whey Natural USA. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Whey Natural USA banner ad today to see why anything less is wasting your money.
Listen strong. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. We're talking with Dr. Eva Schoenhammer. We're talking about melatonin and its linkage to type 2 diabetes. Okay, so when we went into the break, Dr. Schoenhammer, I was talking about The presence of higher levels of melatonin and the possible increase or upregulation of melatonin receptors.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as I said, I defer this to Dr. Russell, but you may have a point there. But as I'm thinking about this, the melatonin levels that we do measure, also the ones that we reported in the paper you were referring to, is essentially a first morning urinary melatonin marker. What we really are probably interested in is the circadian rhythm, so the rhythmical expression of melatonin. And I'm going back to the study of the centenarians, the individuals who got 100 years and older.
Right, right.
The absolute levels that you would measure weren't particularly higher compared to other older individuals, but their rhythm was preserved. They did have a circadian rhythm, whereas many other older individuals with sleep problems and who do get sick oftentimes do not have a well-preserved rhythm, which subsequently leads to sleep problems. And it does make me wonder, I think you do have a good point. How could you upregulate, if that's the mechanism, your melatonin receptors or the function of melatonin overall? But I want to ask, is the best way to do this with a supplement, or shouldn't we try to do this more naturally, since we do know that light and sleep have the strongest effect on this circadian system? Shouldn't we talk about this more than melatonin supplements?
Well, there's a book that we talked about on this show back in, I think it was 2006, and it was written by T.S. Wiley,
mm-hmm.
and it's called Lights Out, The Linkage Between Sleep and Glucose Management. And
yeah.
in the book, she prescribes that we turn the lights out in our home and allow the house to get dark as it gets dark outside, and make that the driving force for us going to bed. Turn the TVs off so there's no external stimulation, and slowly wind down the way our bodies were designed to wind down. And she claims that people who adhere to this completely reverse their diabetes. Now, perhaps it's the return to a natural circadian rhythm and not necessarily the levels of melatonin, as you point out, but to something I've always thought. And that is paying attention to the timing of the melatonin and giving yes. into the timing of the melatonin.
Yeah, right. Or, you know, trying to live a little bit a healthier lifestyle also as far as it pertains to your sleep hygiene. I don't think it's realistic that many people will be able to go to bed at 8 o'clock given all their family and social constraints, but I think it's feasible to give your sleep a little bit of thought and to try to, that's what grandmother told us, to get some sleep before midnight, and I think that's good advice. And maybe to go for a walk or get some sunlight exposure early in the morning right
yes.
after you got up rather than staying in the dark, you know. Granted, it is going to be dark in the winter time for the most part, but at least try, that's why we have light boxes, etc., to stimulate your circadian system in the morning. Has been shown, for instance, in nursing homes to really also affect cognitive function in older people who live in nursing homes, because they don't get outside, and so they really have a lack of this light exposure, particularly in the morning, when that's sort of that's telling the circadian system, hey, you're done with melatonin production. Get up, get alert. It's daytime. This is when the first light basically hits your retina, and then everything else gets set in motion.
Yeah,
that informs the circadian
we've actually talked about the importance of building up the debt, if you will, to sleep by being outdoors and active. And I have to refer to somebody. There's a contributor to the show named Adel Musa who lives in Munster, Germany, and he's listening to the show live today. And as always, when I'm on the air about these exciting topics, Adel is sending me research papers on Facebook, and he just
yeah.
sent one that was performed by the University of Louis Pasteur in Strasbourg, France. Melatonin receptor density and is regulated in rat pars tuberalis and suprachiasmatic nuclei by melatonin itself. And while I'm just glancing at the abstract, I think Adele is implying that the opposite is true of what I suggested, that high melatonin levels begets higher receptor density, because it says here the pineal hormone melatonin, which interacts, blah, blah, it says the density of these receptors is increased after 72 hours of constant light or pinealectomy in both rats, par tuberalis, and suprachiasmatic nuclei, which would imply that the opposite is true, that higher melatonin levels may actually reduce receptor density.
Maybe there is a very tight feedback loop that's sort of controlling this. It wouldn't be the first time that the body is trying to keep a certain balance, so it could make sense. I have to say I'm not so familiar with the receptor literature, but I think this is a very important topic and certainly something that should be followed up on. We're talking about the mechanisms that lead to an effect of melatonin on the human body, and clearly melatonin does have an effect. I think, though, going back to the preventive aspect, the important question that people will ask is, so how can I change my melatonin levels, or how can I best modulate my circadian system so that I remain healthy? And there are, in my view, the three main options, which is melatonin supplements, and we talked about how this may have side effects and may be too early or too premature to recommend this. But then there are the other two natural options, which is sleep hygiene and thinking about light exposure also during the winter time and how to time light exposure and perhaps get more outdoors. And even, considering how this perhaps could affect children if they don't get enough light, sitting in front of the computer all day, and how this might affect the circadian system and may actually be part of why we see this really high obesity rates among kids already today.
Yeah, no doubt about it. We have to take our last commercial break, but what I want to talk about when we come back is something that you inferred to earlier, and that is chronotypes. This has really interested me. And so, I want to ask you if there's a way to determine, our chronotype, because this would seem to be an important factor too. We're talking with Dr. Eva Schoenhammer. We're talking about decreased melatonin secretion, being associated with a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes, especially important to women going through menopause here, that they do everything they can, and men who are going through andropause, to adhere to better sleep standards. You know, I have a funny feeling that sleep is as far upstream as you can get, and addressing all these other diseases independently is unnecessary if we could just get our sleep straightened out. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Have you ever been let down by so-called nitric oxide muscle pump products before? Well, prepare to be shocked. Vengeance is like nothing you've ever tried before. Vengeance leverages several different scientifically proven technologies to deliver what some users say are painfully explosive pumps. If you are satisfied with nitric oxide products that make you wonder if they're working, move on. But if you want a muscle pump that you'll not only feel, but others will see, train with a vengeance. Go to xfmuscle.com today and get vengeance.
I usually avoid protein bars because they're generally just candy in disguise. But that's all changed now. With Quest protein bars, we can enjoy dessert again without the guilt. With 20 grams of whey isolate protein, tons of prebiotic fiber, no sugar added, and only 2 to 6 grams of active carbohydrates per bar, Quest bars will keep you full and lean. I've never endorsed a protein bar before because I simply didn't trust them. That's all changed with the Quest bar. Not just because of what's in them, but more so for what's not. Go to superhumanradio.com today and click the Quest protein bar banner ad. Start enjoying dessert again.
Usually something for nothing is worth nothing, but go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad to get a one-year Life Extension Foundation membership free, plus a $25 product credit. So what does that buy you? Cutting-edge information, knowledgeable health advisors, huge discounts on blood tests and supplements. Want to stay younger and healthier longer? Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Life Extension banner ad and become a Life Extension member now. No cost, no obligation, no kidding.
If you want to outlast, outmuscle and outperform your competition with a high-powered, stimulant-free carbohydrate source that has zero sugars, you want Carbolin. Carbolin is the original high-performance fuel that will allow you to load your muscles with glycogen in minutes instead of hours. As a pre, intra, and post-training supplement, it will give you a hardness and fullness to your muscles like you've never felt before. As an endurance supplement, Carbolin has been proven to increase VO2 max by 2.8%. If you want fast absorption and sustained energy without bloating or cramping, get Carbolin. Go to AAEFX.com today.
Wherever you call your battlefield, after each training engagement, you must recover. Introducing the most complete all-natural and organic recovery formula, AmNutrition's Basic Training, formulated by a military veteran. Basic Training provides the ammunition your body needs to recover and continue the fight. No fake sugar or flavors, no GMOs, less than 1 milligram of sugar and soy per serving, with complete nutrition no other company provides. Arm yourself with the healthiest recovery formula on the market, the body's ammunition, AmNutrition. Join the nutritional revolution by going to muscleandnutrition.com. That's muscle, AmNutrition.com.
Recover!
And nutrition. Calling all men. The Men's Stack is here from Muscle Gauge Nutrition. The Men's Stack will give you the energy you need to train harder and the materials you need to build new muscle. The Men's Stack includes American Protein Isolate, Stimulant-Free Pre-Workout Alpha Rage, Muscle Pump Activator, L-Arginine, AKG, and Multivitamin Plus Minerals specifically formulated for men. Now, Superhuman Radio listeners can get this Men's Stack for just $99 and free shipping while supplies last. Go to superhumanradio.com and click the Muscle Gauge banner ad today.
Get stronger, feel younger. It's Superhuman Radio.
Welcome back to Superhuman Radio. Dr. Schoenhammer, there was a point in human evolution where we slept when we wanted to sleep and for as long as we wanted to sleep. And the industrialization and the agricultural impetus, that changed everything for us. How do you find out what your chronotype is?
The industrialization did indeed change things, but I'm not sure people were able to sleep as long as they could. They sort of followed the sunlight, as you previously pointed out, so they may have wanted to work longer, but they just couldn't because it was dark at night. And I think it would have been much clearer back then what chronotype you are. Let me ask you this question, and that's a way to find out what chronotype you are, Carl. If you think about your typical bedtimes and awakening times, would you consider yourself to be a definite morning type, more likely a morning type, a definite evening type, more likely an evening type, or neither?
No, I'm definitely a morning type.
Okay.
I enjoy going to sleep early. I enjoy getting up early. I love being up early in the morning when the world is quiet. I train very early in the morning. I'm at the gym by 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. I have my best workouts first thing in the morning. I like the mornings. I always have.
Fascinating. Well, you see, there are a couple of questionnaires that are being used to determine a person's chronotype. And I believe the most prominent ones are the Horne-Osterberg one. That's a 19-item questionnaire. Basically, you're being asked 19 different questions that do relate to your sleep-wake habits. And then you can calculate a score, and wherever you fall with your score, this will tell you whether you are one of the five categories that I just listed. One of these questions is precisely the question that I just posed to you, and it has been found out that that question correlates really nicely with the overall score. So in essence, it can be a shortcut, quick, but perhaps not as precise, but nonetheless, still good enough shortcut to find out what chronotype you are. Essentially, it is the fact that we do tend to get more morning types as we get older. People tend to go to bed a little earlier and rise earlier. And there are certain genes that have been linked to the inherent chronotype, but most often to really strange extremes. So there are people who have a sleep phase delay syndrome, meaning that they essentially have totally asocial sleep patterns. And these types of extreme chronotypes have been linked to genetic variants, which does suggest that also the more moderate variations in chronotype are genetically linked. Granted, though, however, there's also environmental factors that even within a family are so similar that it wouldn't be surprising if kids have similar chronotypes than their parents because they all grow up in the same environment. But what I'm trying to say, there's simple ways. There's also the Munich Chronotype Questionnaire that was developed in Germany that also helps you assess your chronotype, and you can do this online. You can find it if you go to a search engine and look for Munich Chronotype.
Well, even faster, go to my Facebook page. Adele Musa already put it up there by the University of Munich.
Perfect. Yeah, yes. Yeah. So you can play around and find out what chronotype you are. But I think the most interesting amongst those chronotypes are the ones that are definitely evening types and bimodal or neither, the sort of group of people who can't categorize themselves because they have such irrational and erratic sleeping patterns that they're neither morning nor evening types. And it has been suggested that perhaps these are the individuals who are more prone to circadian disruption if they do encounter things that, you know, could lead to changes in the circadian rhythm, more so than, let's say, a definite morning type like yourself. So clearly there is much more to be learned, and it's probably of great importance what chronotype you are, sort of the basis for assessing how susceptible your circadian system altogether is to any potential changes or disruption that may occur throughout life. And there's another very interesting study that I quickly wanted to point out.
Please.
It's an animal study that was conducted at Vanderbilt University a few years ago that also points to how important light and circadian disruption can be even when you are still in the womb, because they showed that rats, when they were still in the womb of the mother rats, if you expose them to different light cycles, you could actually change their risk of developing anxiety and depression later on. So essentially, this suggests that what we are talking about is not only important for children or for adults or for older individuals, it's also perhaps even important for when you aren't even born, and suggests that the sleep-wake cycle and light and how these things interplay are really, really fundamentally important to our health, I believe.
You know, I don't understand why more research isn't being done in this area, because I really sincerely believe what I said going into the break, that a whole entire host of diseases that we're trying to treat individually, types of cancers, insulin resistance, and so on and so forth, can all be mitigated by understanding the importance of adhering to proper sleep cycles. And, you know, when you look at the centenarians that you were talking about before, I am convinced, I just know it viscerally, I just know that these individuals probably went to sleep. They let's put it this way. These individuals tend to have ritualistic style of life. They eat the same foods. They do the same thing. But more importantly, they go to sleep at the same time every single night, and they get up at the same time every single morning. And this regularity, as it relates to sleep, allows them some sort of protective mechanism against diseases that allows them to live until their hearts can no longer beat. That's what ends up sending them on their way.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that with the shortage in money now, of course, our research budgets are being cut, and that's not only affecting us but everyone. But I do want to say that certainly I agree that society should be totally interested in finding out more about these associations. And maybe there is a private donor or a private foundation that's listening in and wants to support. I think we could do much more would we have more support than we currently have. And I'm not saying we don't have any, but there is so much more to be done that I think, especially here at Harvard, we could pull out a much larger number of studies and get at the bottom of this much faster. Would we have more money available?
But you know what the only problem is, Dr. Schoenheimer? We have entire industries that would be threatened. If we could prove conclusively that this disease or that disease is exclusively caused by staying up and breaking sleep, you have law enforcement, you have the package delivery.
No, but that's not true, Carl, because my specialty is actually looking at shift work and what it does to the circadian system and subsequently health. And it's absolutely a necessity in our society, and we're so grateful for all the individuals, including myself as a physician, who work night shifts. I think there's no question that we won't eliminate that, but it is equally valuable for these people to find out what the best way is to do shift work, you know. And it could be that there's only a certain number of years each person should work night shifts, and that wouldn't affect their health. But if it's beyond, let's say, a certain number of years, then one would counsel them to perhaps not pursue shift work longer. So there are probably a multitude of things that could be done to help them minimize their risk. And that's another really important research area. So I don't see this as a problem, but rather as an opportunity to really find out
to get it right,
to support these really important members of society.
Yeah, I like that. You're right. I'm a bit of a cynic, unfortunately, and but I agree with you. Listen, Dr. Schoenheimer, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. This is a very, very important discussion. that leads to so many more questions that I hope are going to be answered in my lifetime.
Hope so too.
Great research. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carl. Bye-bye.
Okay. Another great show. Hope you got something good out of it. I sure did. I'm actually going to be listening to this episode later on in the day. Thanks to everybody that was on the show. Thanks to Dr. Bruce Blumberg from University of California at Irvine. Thanks to Dr. Cheryl Watson from University of Texas, Medical Branch at Galveston. And, of course, Dr. Eva Schoenhammer from Brigham and Women's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And thank you to the listeners, because without you, I'd be just talking to myself. We'll see you tomorrow. And thanks to Adele Musa, who always makes me look so smart. I couldn't forget you.
Listening to the Superhuman Channel. Don't hate us because we feel good.